Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 2nd, 1998. In the fireside room this evening is Walter Wangren Jr. The session number is 98-4, and it's titled Spirituality and Story, Hospitality Part 4, Service. Let's listen in.
It's a way to get silence, except that you're so quick right now, Ed. Try this one. So if you're in front of a large auditorium, a room full of people, and they're not becoming quiet, just in doleful tones, begin to recite the Ten Commandments. By the time you get to the fifth commandment, they'll be quiet, wondering what's happening, because it will seem like some sort of significant delivery. We're rolling, I think. My name is Walt Wangren. This is the last in a series that I've been presenting that deals with hospitality as one of the issues that appear in the book that we've been using as a sort of a groundwork for our dialogue and discussion this summer, Practicing Our Faith, which Dorothy Bass edited and wrote for. I've said from the beginning that what I'm doing in my talks here, I divided hospitality into these five parts. With four presentations, I skipped food. I think you all have been thinking about that pretty good this week. And now we're at service. We'll do a little bit of a reprise of some of the others when we hit the significant text or passage. I want to thank you, though. For many of you, this may be the last time we'll be meeting because you might be going out on the weekend. And there are two things for which I want very much to thank you and hope that you understand. Preliminary comment, I have never not been nervous to talk. I used to pray, God, when I was young, could I get over this? God said no. I didn't hear that word no, I just never got over it. I just always have been nervous to talk. And it doesn't matter if there are a few people or many. If they're close friends or if they're strangers, it just always happens. And I can think of a lot of good reasons why I do and a lot of bad reasons why I do. But there are two things that a good group of people does. In response to me that I find kind, and you've been doing it. The one is that you have given my words a place to lodge. Language is not language until somebody hears it, listens to it, thinks about it. And not always when speakers speak do people open up their ears and their minds and allow words a place to lodge. A lot of time when I am communicating with you or people like you, you're not there. I'm writing. I'm in a little studio all by myself and writing, and I have to presume your interest because you're not there to say that you are. And a lot of times I'm sitting in, when I do Lutheran Vespers, I'm in a very, very small booth, a tiny little booth, because we have to keep all the sounds of the Lutherans out. we're at the Higgins Road Mausoleum, and they bang and make noise and all that sort of stuff, so we have to close me in. So I can't see anyone then either, but I presume you. Moments like this, whether or not you read, that's not what I'm saying, or listen to Lutheran Vespers, moments like this persuade me and comfort me that people give me a place to lodge, give my words a place to lodge. And since my words are pretty much of what I am, you have been hosting me throughout this week. The second thing you do, I don't know whether you know you do it, but I certainly seek it, and it often does not come, is forgiveness. An audience that is willing to forgive a speaker, that is to say, to work with and overlook mistakes, recognize the sinfulness of the one who talks and the complete forgiveness that God gives and shines through you, is also for me it's a tremendous gift. You may imagine that I speak often and there are people who are not sitting as you are, they're sitting like this. They're waiting for me to say that thing which is on their agenda. Yeah. Waiting for me to say something that will right away say, see, I knew what he was about, or something like that. That's one of the things that does make me nervous, and I know that. Whether that's a good or a bad reason or not, I don't know. But to realize that in a presentation such as these are, especially when one gets personal, there are bound to be the evidences of sin. I know that. I know I don't get up here and shine like gold. I know I sin, and I'm so grateful when people also forgive me in return. This is the Spirit's dialogue, you must understand. This is where our souls represent the presence of God one to another, and I'm extremely grateful for that. And I could go on, but those two things I wanted especially to thank you for. When Holden works, which it doesn't always, but when Holden works, this is what it does, among other things.
I have been also treating myself, and I'll treat myself one more time by reading you some of the carols and ballads I've written for this Christmas book. I read you Gold the first night, those of you who are here on Monday, and I'm going to make some reference to it in just a little bit, but not much. I will refer also to Myrrh in a moment, but here, this is sort of melancholy carol. I don't know why it comes out like that sometimes. You just sit down and you get an image. This is called its own first line, Sing Softly the Cherries. Sing softly the cherries, red, red, sweet and good. Sing apples and oranges, the cinnamon food. Dance swiftly the cider, spin more than you should, for liquor and laughter will lighten your load. Declaim the roast turkey and riddle the sauce. Potatoes are stories of riches and loss. Pipe merrily, carrots, drum, beets till they bleed. They root down in darkness who started as seed. Oh, candy the greetings you give to your guests. The wassail is fleeting and life ends in death. So taffy your handshake and ginger the kiss. Bake huggings like muffins, a brave Eucharist. Be feast for my Christmas, and I'll be your food. Beg Christ to assist us in everything good. I like that one. I don't even know why I like it, but I
can taste it.
Yeah, well, you know what the fancy word for that is synesthesia, where you mix up things that really shouldn't be mixed up in the senses and so forth. I think I'll just stop with that one. I need to get on with it. So, thank you for listening to that and our last presentation. Gifts for the infant. This may not seem like it's going to fit at first. I want to talk about service, and I will end with the blessing that is returned to our service. All of this working well, this hospitality with its proper source, it's the room that is furnished and made ready, and the food, and the act of service itself in the talk. All of these things we will see redound in blessing to the hosts. A blessing from God, actually. And Jesus is the one who declares it in the second last beatitude ever mentioned, which is not in Matthew, it is in John 13. The last beatitude is in John 20. And I'll let you just think about that second last beatitude for a while. This is not bothering anyone, is it, that sound?
Is it bothering you?
No, I just want to be sure that all is sweet and good here. All is not sweet and good? Is that what you're shaking your head? No, yeah. He's shaking his head because it doesn't bother him. All right. So come the kings unto the infant. And they bring three gifts in Matthew. What I'm about to tell you is not necessarily, be clear on this, it's not necessarily just biblical exegesis. It's what the church has done with these details and symbols that exist in our Gospels. And the church has done this from monumental, very early, very within the early centuries. They began thinking about what these gifts should mean. So they come to the infant, who may be anywhere 1 to 2 years old, and they give unto the infant gold and frankincense and myrrh. And immediately the church starts cogitating on what do those gifts mean. And obviously there are some surface meanings that are there that we all recognize and are at peace with. But it might be important to realize what these things meant in context of the day. In context, not just in Syria, the world was very compact. The things that happened in Arabia and Syria and in Palestine were not much different, finally, from what happened in Greece and in Rome. It was a tight world. And so these gifts are not uncommon as you bring them, although there gets to be something a little bit uncommon in the way in which they work their ways out in the Gospels. Let me just break it down for you, the first two. Gold. Remarkably, I mean this, remarkably, in the story of Jesus, gold has almost no place. This is remarkable, and it was remarkable to the Christians themselves to say, this hero is not like the other heroes. This one, whom we might indicate, shall reign in the seat of David, as the angel says, nevertheless reigns with no gold whatsoever. This is peculiar. In all the stories told of the kings, or those who were royal, or those who were heroes, and certainly those who had godlike qualities, as we have here, gold was all over the place. In the Gospels, it doesn't exist. It starts cropping up in the book of Revelation, as you perhaps know. So it's remarkable. But nevertheless, gold had two meanings.
Gold given unto the infant was a declaration that this was a king. It is a royal gift. But immediately flip that around, because there's always a sense of the hand that gives and the hand that receives. So as the hand gives unto a king gold, so the king touching that gold and giving it back, so this Jesus touching that gold gives back unto that hand or unto us virtue. What unto Jesus declared royalty signified unto those who made such a gift virtue. So gold has this double meaning. You're following me? One to the one and one to the giver. Frankincense was always a worshipful thing. It was other things as well, but with regard to the little Jesus, to this Christ, it indicated the holiness and the godliness of this figure. This is how the church interpreted it. Why? Because in all temples, including the temple in Jerusalem, whenever one stood facing the image of God, between the priest or whoever that one was and the image, was always the burning of incense, a significant portion of which was frankincense. That was its significant thing. It declared the boundary between the ineffable and the spiritual and the real. It declared the boundary between the created in, let me go straight to Jerusalem now, between the priest, like Zechariah, who lit the incense, you know, and of course the angel would appear immediately, of course, at the lighting of incense, because incense is the declaration of the presence of God, but it's a fierce warning, don't cross this fire, don't cross that fire, because on the other side you might die. In all the other temples, there would be an image of God. In Jerusalem, it was the holiest place. It was that cube of darkness where the presence of God was said to rest and to wait. And that was the fearfulness. Only once a year would one actually enter into there. And even then, you'll notice, they would go in with a sacrifice, taking the sacrifice in, because you're pressing, as we say, the envelope. I mean, you're coming very, very close to that which, if you looked upon it, could swallow you up. Created, looking upon Creator, is literally like looking into the vastness of all that is inchoate and uncreated, the source of all things. So, when they brought it to Jesus and placed it between themselves and Jesus, said the early church, there was a declaration that this one was God. That this one was God. But the reverse is true too. When that God receives frankincense, then throughout the Middle East is this marvelous symbol that the smoke, that pungent, sharp, make your nose drool, smell, smoke was the prayers of the faithful, which should rise up to God. And that's not just in our Bible, although it is there. You should both Old and New Testament, that the prayers of those who are faithful is a savory odor. It's, oh, there's such beautiful words. It's a good smell in the nostrils of God. God loves to smell that prayer. So on the one hand, it's a declaration of deity. On the other hand, it's an honoring of the prayers themselves that go up like smoke, like incense. Now you know what I'm talking about. Now let's pause for a moment. Gold doesn't appear anymore in the story of this particular individual, Jesus, and so the kingship is always not the kingship of this world. It gets talked, and it fetches up at exactly the right point in John and in others. It fetches up at the moment of glory. The hour has come, and it's at the cross. So this cross is the throne, and any common sense of kingship is lost. Frankincense, likewise, not only vanishes, but it's in the temple which Jesus declares shall cease to be. This division between God and humanity, this boundary line between the Creator and the created, Jesus declares that no stone shall stand upon another. What Jesus is saying is this kultus, this cult, this way in which these people declare their relationship and the breakage of it to God is ending. It's ending here when the temple goes. So frankincense likewise, and the whole issue of burning that sort of thing, also in at least the Gospels, not necessarily in our churches where we use incense and continue to, but in the Gospels, there's a declaration that the deity division from humanity also passes in Jesus. Jesus is genuinely among us, but myrrh continues. Myrrh continues, and that's the one I want to come to. It's referred to at least twice over in the Gospels. It's in Matthew, of course, that we get the gifts. It's in Mark that myrrh is touched upon, and in John, it's so abundant. John does things like that. It's so abundant you can't believe how much myrrh. And do you remember where myrrh is mentioned first? In this case, it's in Mark, actually. When Jesus is getting ready to be nailed to the cross, they bring him wine mixed with myrrh. He refuses that. He will drink later on. and he'll drink, but at that moment he refuses, but nevertheless they bring it to him, which is a genuine remembrance of Proverbs, that you bring this little wine for one who is dying. But Jesus refuses it, and then he receives it when he's dead. It's in the end of John. It's in John chapter 19, when Nicodemus, who has not shown his face a lot, who always appears at night, this questioning one, brings to Joseph of Arimathea 200 pounds of myrrh and aloes with which to prepare this body for burial. This continues. Now, having said that, I need to read you something. Does this feel a little bit more like teaching today? Well, let me tell you, I have a cold and I've been taking Contact. I'll try to work past that as we go. Oh, that's the other thing to forgive me for. One of the stories I'm going to tell you might have heard. This is Ovid's Metamorphoses. Some of you perhaps have read Ovid's Metamorphoses. In here is the story of Mira. This is her name, Mira, with the A. And that's why I've added it right here. Oh, what does myrrh mean? Let me just say it, you already know. It means the death, the suffering and the death of this one. That's why it reappears again. And that's why this doesn't go away. It's the suffering and the death of this one. And to the giver, what does it mean? Participation. Our participation, both in pain and in glory, both in dying and in rising again, our participation in that suffering and death. And that's where we get to service, dear people. That's why I'm telling you about this. Because it's our participation as well in Jesus' suffering for the world that we would suffer as well. Yes?
How exactly was the myrrh used with the body? Was it stuffed in the orifices? Was it rubbed over the body?
It was rubbed. It was rubbed like an ointment. First of all, it would be filled in the clothing. So that the clothing that they wrap, very likely shrouded, as well as the napkin for the face, would have been soaked in myrrh, completely soaked. And then they would have anointed the entire body. Of course, this would be in John, because in the synoptics, they don't have a chance to do this. But John allows this richness of recognition of the death. But that's how they would do it. Now, the nostrils and all that sort of stuff, as I'm sure you know, has something to do when they embalm the body. And when they're going to try to save it later on alive. And they may have done that as well. Well, anyway, so here is a story. Here is a story of a woman whose name is Mira, who lived on Cyprus, which is the place that Barnabas came from. And Ovid writes this story down just a generation before Jesus is born, a little bit less than that. In fact, Ovid is still living when Jesus is born. So this story is intensely close to Jesus. And I'm thinking that there might have been people like Luke who would have known this story. Although I don't know if they pay much mind to it, but it's interesting to say what this myrrh means and what Jesus is in for. Mira is one of the many daughters of a king whose father's name was Paphos, where Paul visited. You see how close all this is? Okay, Cnidus was his name, and he is said to have instituted prostitution, ritual and priestess-like prostitution for certain holy days on the island of Cyprus. Now, here's the horrible thing, and even Ovid says this is horrible. His daughter conceives for her father this inordinate love. She loves him to distraction. And what happens is she gets sick and pale, which we know can happen and happens over and over again in these stories. So her nurse says, what's the matter? And finally, she discloses this horrible love. But the nurse is kind to the daughter and says, look, wear this priestess's garment, go into your father. This is not a story that we don't have in scriptures either. So in goes the daughter to her father. Her father doesn't know who it is. He impregnates her. This happens several times until finally he wants to know who this beautiful woman is, and he turns the torches on and he finds his daughter, Mira, and he explodes in rage that this daughter should have pulled this trick upon him. I don't know whether he knows that she's pregnant or not. He explodes in rage and he goes after her to kill her. She runs, begging the gods for some kind of... I should even read you what Ovid says here. It's remarkable what he says, and it shows some of the differences here. She runs away from her father, begging the gods that they might protect her. Filled with anger too great for words, he snatched his gleaming sword from the sheath where it hung. Mira fled. In the darkness, and by the way, if you've not read the Metamorphoses, you ought to. It's very exciting tales. I mean, he writes well, is what I mean to say. In the darkness and concealment which night offered, she was saved from death. This way and that she roamed across the broad lands of her father's kingdom till she left the palm trees of Arabia and Pontius fields behind her, fetched up in Gilead, she did. For 9 months she wandered at length, tired out, rested in the lands of Sabaea. By this time she was scarcely able to support the burden she carried in her womb. Afraid of death, yet sick of life, filled with guilt, by the way, not knowing what to pray for, she had recourse to these petitions. O God, if gods, if such there be, who listen to a penitent, I have deserved grievous punishment, nor do I shrink from it, but in case I should be contaminate the living by my presence, if I live, or dead if I die, banish me to the realms of both, from the realms of both. And then this is what Ovid writes. There is a deity who hears the prayers of penitents. There is a deity who hears the prayers of penitence, for certainly her last prayer did not fall on deaf ears. But he never names the deity. I mean, they're crowded with gods. They're overwhelmed with goddesses. And in there, sneaking around, there is a deity who hears penitence. Well, you know, that's several religions are built on that whole idea. Okay, so earth heaped itself around her legs as she spoke, and roots breaking through her toenails stretched sideways, forming foundations for a tall trunk. Her bones were changed into hard wood, and through the marrow, which survived in the interior, flowed up sap instead of blood. Her arms became large branches, her fingers smaller ones, and her skin hardened into bark. The growing tree had already encased her laden womb, had spread over her breast, and was about to cover up her neck. Impatient of delay, she sank down to meet the wood as it rose and buried her face in the bark. If you ever did see a myrrh bush, you'd know what they're talking about. Though she lost her former feelings when she lost her body, yet she still weeps, and warm drops flow from the tree. Even her tears are renowned, and the myrrh that drips from her trunk retains its mistress's name. Men will speak of it to all eternity. But the infant that Mira had inside of her grew so large that its bulk burst the bark, and it was born through the bark, and the naiads of the river that were there gathered this child together, but there was no milk for the child. And so what they did was set goats to eat the leaves of this tree, to eat the leaves of this tree. And as the goats did, their beards would touch the tears. And that's what they told her son that they were feeding her. The tears of your mother, so sad for you, the tears of your mother for her guilt, becomes myrrh. And the baby's name is Adonis. Now, the reason I'm telling you that, it just suddenly opens up this. What we bring to Jesus is the tears of our guilt. What we bring to Jesus is the tears of our destroying and our destroyed desires. What we bring to Jesus also, which may not have anything to do with guilt, are the tears of our loss. Those things that we love that are taken from us, those things that we've twisted by foolish loves, these are the tears that we bring unto Jesus. And when Jesus rises from that tomb, the myrrh that's in the shroud and the napkin are left behind. We rise too. So when you say participation in the suffering and death of Jesus, you mean two things. One is the participation cleanses us of all these horrible things we might have been involved in, or all the sorrows that others' horrible things may have caused for us. That's the service Jesus renders. And it becomes that broader service that in his presence now is also the suffering of many, many people. We'll get to that in just a minute. And Jesus' work is again and again to comfort those who suffer. Myrrh is sustained in the Gospels, where gold and frankincense pass away. How shall I tell you this next story? Let me do it. Let me set it up for you first. You noticed that if you've been with me, I've been linguistic. Let me be linguistic once again. I'm calling this portion Glory into Glory. And there were a bit of a reprise here. How do we serve? Out of what shall we serve? Out of what attitude and peacefulness? Peacefulness, really. In the Old Testament, the word that we translate glory is kavod. Kavod. The glory of God. Kavod. That glory is sometimes a frightening thing. It can break forth like smoke and wrath in what we call a Shekinah. When God comes down upon the mountain, everybody trembles because there's lightning and smoke upon the top of the mountain. And when God speaks, people want to run away. It sounds like trombones or trumpets or a holding parade or something. Loud and frightening and cacophony. No. Loud and frightening and godly. And the word for that glory, the word for that glory has as its major image weight, not light, heaviness, weight. Heaviness, which is authority. When I went to Concordia, Milwaukee and started taking German as a freshman in high school, we didn't have choices. I had a teacher whose name was Jakob, Gunter Jakob. And he walked into the room throwing his weight around, you understand? That's throwing this great weight around. He had an umbrella stuck right out in front of him whenever he walked like that. And I know that was to get people out of the way. Because it was always straight up. But here was that weight. It would shake the room. Also, he would say, eins. And so not only do we have that weight, we had a quiz. That's how he began everything. Just drenched poor little students like me. Also, eins. Write your quiz. Rosh Hashanah, New Year's Day. See if you can see it. New Year's Day in the time just after King Uzziah died. New Year's Day, it's in the fall, after King Uzziah has died. See a young man. If you can see here the temple, you're all sitting in the temple. These are the doors of the temple. They're flung wide open. They don't fling open, they grind open. But they're wide open, and it's before the dawn. It's before the sunrise. And here come the priests. They have gone to the east of the courtyards, and they have opened up the great doors to the east. And what do you see there? Great door, you look down into the Kidron Valley, and across the Kidron Valley is the Mount of Olives. It's straight, it's remarkably straight, to the east of the door and the sanctuary, the holy place, and the holiest place is the Mount of Olives. And where shall the sun rise? Over the Mount of Olives. On that high holy day, the priests are kneeling in the doorway of the temple, and one of them is likely a young man. A young man from a family of priests, probably just doing service because priests served the older priests as they knelt there. And all of a sudden, if you can imagine this, the incense is burning. And so there's a cloud inside of this temple. We're about to have a light show. Boy, sometimes I go to these concerts and they blow so much smoke. Have you seen? And then they get really fancy with lights and smoke, but they always need that smoke there. I'm going, nobody hears me, of course, but I'm missing the music. So we're about to have a light show because the sun, exactly at dawn, rises over there. And here's the point. It throws its darts. It throws its golden darts straight from behind these priests into that smoke. Whoo, it becomes effulgent. Now it's a luminous smoke. And the idea is that it could crack right through that to the darkness on this holy day. The light of God cracks through into the darkness where God dwells. What a remarkable thing. And Isaiah says, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. I saw the Lord high and lifted up. And the hem of the garment, the train of the garment, filled the temple, which is that smoke coming from the altar of incense, filled the temple. And standing, however that is, above the deity, are these burning ones, these seraphim, these burning angels, which, by the way, oh, I've got to say this. Next week when I talk, I'm going to draw upon Annie Dillard's book, Holy the Firm. And she speaks of the angels. This is a remarkable book, y'all. And she speaks of the angels. She says, I have read, this is not her thought, it really is an old medieval thought, I have heard that the seraphim stand in the direct presence of God. And when they try to cry out holy three times, they only get one holy out. For very love, they burn in flames. Every time the love, they say holy once, and the love in them bursts flame, and they melt away in flames when they say their first holy. Well, I don't know about that. Because they got three out while Isaiah was there listening. Holy, 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 they cry. Well, you know, then they have these wings, and with two they cover their mouths, and with two they cover their feet, which is to say, those parts that might be embarrassing upon the human body. And with two they flew, and one cried unto the other, and each one said, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God of hosts, which can mean a lot of things, but I'm going to go past that right now. Hosts are the stars in the sky, which are the warriors of God, which are all the powerful elements of the universe. The whole earth, ha-eretz, kol ha-eretz in Hebrew, the whole earth is filled with this glory. Boom. Well, of course the poor guy shakes. Thundering glory. It's frightening. It's wonderful. Maybe you pay money to see such a thing, but your money burns right up. It's frightening. So that what poor Isaiah says is, oh, my heaven, I am a man of unclean lips. I come from a people of unclean lips. Woe is me. I'm going to die. Of course, that's what happens in glory, unless God does this kind thing of bringing forgiveness and touches those unclean lips. Wipes the sin away. But I tell you that because of this phrase, the whole earth, kol ha'eretz. Earth in Hebrew means at least two things. It's a huge word. One, it means the country, the land. Right now, Israel, its paper is, isn't it, its newspaper? Ha'eretz? I think it is. And it means the country. But it also means all the inhabited realms of the universe. That's what it means. That's the thunder nation that's going on here. That is to say, everything has the impress of the weight and the authority of God. This is an impositional power. And when it's God, you cannot say no to it, or, I mean, it'll kill you. So everything, I mean, this is a good thought. The grasshoppers, the roaches, the little ants that are running around in our chalet right now are impressed by the glory of God. That glory can be marvelous but frightening. You know, people say to me, I go out into the woods and I worship, and I say, blessings on you. I hope you find mercy there. But I know you can find all kinds of things about God, but you may have to carry something with you into those woods. You may have to carry some revelation with you into those woods. Because if you stand in woods and you say, look on high, look at that beautiful hawk. Look at that wheeling hawk that never, and I say that, never flaps its wings, it finds the thermals. And you know those broad, gracious wings are attached to a yellow eye that looks all the way down here and sees the mouse poke its head out. Or maybe you're down here with the children and you're saying, oh, how cute, those little whatever they are. Are they ground squirrels or are they chipmunks? They're both. They're both. Well, let's take the chipmunks. Oh, how cute the chipmunks are. See how good God is. See how good God is. And then all of a sudden you hear, if you are fortunate, you hear the vibration of the wings of the hawk when it comes down. Falconers know this. It's a frightening sound. It's a thrumming sound. I can't even do fast enough. It's just a fierce vibration. And animals get to know that, except that the hawk stoops so fast that sometimes it beats its own sound to the ground. Boom! With those claws, picks up that cute little chipmunk and soars into the glory. This is the glory of God. This is the glory of God. It is what allows there to be something like order in the midst of the chaos of all things, the impress. But I say unto you, Jesus changes glory into glory, and unto the whole church, I do with all my heart suggest that we do not use this glory as the source of our activity one unto another, but we do.
There are a whole lot of us pastors who don't care. Why, I think I had my weight the moment I left the seminary and walked into that church, which really needed to hear from me.
But Jesus turns glory into glory. And the New Testament word translated glory for us is doxa. Doxa. And its image is light. Just so that you see how that concept light plays even in our own English language. It is the illustrious one. It is the luminary. It is the shining of light in places, I'm going to tell you and prove it, in places of darkness. It's the sunlight that came out of the east on Rosh Hashanah and lit the interior of the temple. It's that. It's the sunlight which was mute, but lit the temple. It's giftiness. It's mercy. Why? This is... Allow me to say this. If this doesn't make sense to you, just wash it away, forget it. But doxa is associated with a cognate dokein in Greek, which means to seem or to appear. Some of you know about the docetic heresy, which means that Jesus wasn't really human. He just appeared human. So it's a seeming thing. But the word dokein also means reputation, how you seem to the people around you. It's your reputation. Now, in all cultures, and especially in these cultures, but also the Native American cultures, one of the ways in which people elevated their reputation, please, without hypocrisy, this is the way they did it, was to give gifts. It was constantly to recognize that what you had as a kind of, you had it as a vouchsafed, well, as a keeping from God to shed unto others. So glory is attached with giftiness as well as mercy, as Jesus' parables suggest. These are the ones, you know, unto whom you owe much, and they forgive you. They forgive you the debt. This is glory, it's light. And as they say, it's reputation. When you say reputation, then finally get to this. It is the presence of that, it's the presence, even if it's the spiritual presence of that one. Where does this take us? It takes us to Philippians chapter 2, verses 5 and following, which many of you can quote to me. Have this mind among yourselves, which you have in Christ Jesus, who, though this Jesus was in the form. And that doesn't mean, in our language, form may mean sort of like in the image or like, but not real. No.
That Greek concept form means Jesus has this godly quality of authority, who was in the form of God, but did not count this equality with God, this weight, this power with God, a thing to be kept. But Jesus emptied himself from glory into glory. Jesus emptied himself and took upon two forms, two images. One, human, just like us. Look where God goes. Look where God goes. God descends from the temple and from the glory of the hosts of heaven and takes a place right here. And then goes even lower. Now, you know all this. You know this. This is the radical change of glory. So that he humbled himself not just unto death, but death on the cross. Now, dear people, where does this glory shine? And where does it bring just shocking surprise? Where folks are dying. Where folks are sick. Where folks are outcast from the government, Rome, from the church. We've had some discussions like that here. This is where the glory shines in darkness. This is the sun that lights from the east, the interior of the temple. It comes into the temple. Therefore has God highly exalted this Jesus and given unto Jesus the name which is above all names, so that, and this is the universe now, it's just like in Isaiah, so that those that are above the earth, on the earth and under, this is a tripartite universe, means everything, should, every knee, I guess, first, should bow, and every tongue declare that, and here comes the first confession of the Christians. They probably cried this when they came out of the water baptized, that Jesus is Lord. That was the confession to the glory of God the Father. Now, any sort of lordship doesn't come now from this, needs recognized. It comes because of the humility of entering into the condition and the place of human beings. Let me give you an example. I'm not going to use their names. I'll just make up names for them. It's a husband and a wife, and I'm going to call him Elijah Johnson. And I'm going to call her Helen Johnson. They're teachers. Well, he's a principal. He's a principal at middle school in Evansville, and she's a third grade teacher. She is a woman of this kind of glory. She scares me, honestly. This is an African-American woman who absolutely knows. Listen, she was the only one from her family. Her father was a miner, and she was the only one who literally took herself to a college and began to work. She just took individual classes first. When they found out she was intelligent, I mean, she took it by steps, then they allowed her not only to enter into their institution, but also to receive grants and scholarships. She graduated, she came to Evansville from Kentucky, and she began to teach. And somewhere in there she met Elijah, who also graduated. Now, she's the kind of woman who was just solid. She had a low center of gravity. And this is not, I mean, this is weight. This is not fat. This is not, no, but it is weight. I mean, it's size. And she had cheeks. She had shining black cheeks. You can see you're standing at the. And if any third grader made a noise back there, she would whip around and sunlight, choom, come snapping off those cheeks. And the children would say, go quiet. Well, I know that because she would do it to me. Well, when Than and I, when I began as pastor, we were living sort of outside of the city. This is inner city. And there was no doubt we had to move to the inner city. And we found a nice house. Really nice. I'm not kidding you. You know, location, location, location. If it's an African-American community, no whites behind. So you get really good houses, really cheap. And I called up Helen. And I said, Helen, we're thinking of moving to this house, which is right, you know, across from the park in the library. What do you think? Oh, she just snapped fire. She said, our people down here, they smoke dope out of there. They drink out of there. You don't want to be there. They make noise all night. Boombox, yada, yada, yada. And that's how she was. She could not brook people being sloppy, being less than what they should be, and she would put the fear of Helen in them. it was a good house, and she was right. As long as we lived there, which is years and years and years, they smoked dope outside. I figured out how to handle that, and they drank and stuff. But the worst thing was that I made Helen mad at me. Worse than that was Helen. She thought her husband was altogether too liberal. Elijah was a tall man. I'm 6'1". He was at least 6'5 or 6'6", but then he had this huge afro he wore, which was honestly like a glory round his head. It was beginning to gray. And if the sun hit him, it was like smoke. It was like smoke. And he was slow-moving and kind, principal of this school. He laughed like this. He would laugh. And you'd hear it throughout the whole place. He was the president my second year in that parish. He was the president of our congregation, so I'd go visit him. And she said he was liberal because of the way he dealt with the children. He carried dimes. The schools in those days would make popcorn, you know, and they'd sell bags of popcorn to the kids for a dime. So Mr. Johnson would walk in the hall, and people would come to him, little children would come out of class to him, and they'd just paw on him. But this was his way of learning their names and putting that huge hand on their shoulder or patting their back or what have you, but indicating relationship by giving them the dimes. I would walk in and Mr. Johnson would be at the end of the hall with children surrounding him, and he would see me, and I'd see him raise those strong arms like this to wave. Little kids hanging. Little kids hanging from his... They're like sausages, you know, or like Christmas ornaments. He'd raise, and you'd hear that laugh over these children. One time, he and I were walking during class down the hall, and we turned into a hall we had not been in, and there was a little girl sitting at the end of the hall, a little white girl, sitting with her back to the wall itself and her knees pulled up, little white knees, like sticks, you know, you just crack, break them. And she had her head down, muslin dress something. And I felt his stride change when he saw this child down there. He kept walking and talking softly to me. But when he came alongside that child, he just paused. He didn't look at her. I mean, he's huge and she's little. He didn't look at her. He just stood still and I felt quiet. I'm here. And he said, oh, et me, he said. Oh, et me. She's so sad. And I watched that little child, oh, call her name, look up, so sad. Oh, she almost cried. He was right. And to say it, she almost lost it. Put her head down again, and he just stood there. He said, she's so sad, and I know what she wants. She's looking up now. And he says, but I can't give it to her. She's looking down. He says, I can't give her what she wants, but I can give her the gettin'. He says, I can give her the gettin'. And he pulls that huge hand, that hand as big as a shovel, out, and he goes to shake her pretty little white hand. It was so white you could see the veins. And they shook hands together, her hand disappeared in his. And when he pulled his hand away, never looking at her, she had the getting, a dime. He told me at Thanksgiving that he was going to go into the hospital around Christmas because he had pains in his side and they needed to diagnose what this was. But he had planned it to go in the day that school was out so he could be back at school as soon as it was in session again in January. Well, Elijah went in and they opened him up. I was there and Helen was there, and I was beginning at that moment to see what I was going to see a lot of in Helen. We prayed, the three of us, but she folded her arms. They opened him up and they just closed him again. The cancer had metastasized throughout all of his organs, and so there was nothing that could be done. They didn't honestly even suggest radiation, although they might have. I mean, they talked about that, and so he was going to die. And I came back to visit Elijah again and again, and we would talk, and he would laugh, and sometimes he would take my hand in that huge hand of his. But always, if Helen was there, she'd be standing back by the window. Here's his bed. Head of it there, foot of it here, there's the door. She'd always be back here by the window with her arms folded, just hard, and the sunlight slanting off her cheeks. She was so angry. Glory and authority is breaking down, I think. I'm telling you more. I wasn't even thinking of that. She just was angry. And when I would come, she wouldn't even look at me. Whatever I represented, she wouldn't look at me. And he grew worse. His cheeks began to sink in, and he lost flesh in his temples. His beautiful dark skin grew ashy, like someone just spread ashes. He got flat on the back of his head from his... And his eyes got real thin, and sometimes we would think he was asleep or comatose or something. He's getting so skinny in bed. I came once in early February, and I surprised Helen. She was leaning over the bed. I walked in here, and she was leaning over the bed like this. Her face was no farther than this from his face. His eyes were half-lidded. It looked like a saint, some icon, staring off to the corner. And she was just leaning like this, with not touching, her hands up, like this, just inches from his mouth. And then I made a sound, and she saw me, and she snapped straight up. She went over to that window, and she folded her arms again. And I heard this. Elijah was awake. He was wide awake. He was enjoying the closeness of his sad wife.
And then he said this. He said, "Oh, Helen," he said, "I know what she needs, and I can't give it to her," he said, "but I can give her the getting." And he took my hand and he said, "Pastor, pray with me." And we prayed the Lord's Prayer. She stood. We prayed, "Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come," and so forth, all the way through. There is such a thing as a death rattle. Some of you may know. I did not know till that time. We were both there, both Helen and myself. We were in his hospital room, and it was like mid-morning, and I heard that it's like dried ice. It's like shaking dried ice. There's nothing human about it at all, and it's on the edge of all things, that rattle. And I saw Helen snap up as if just her whole being tingled at that sound. I recognized it too. She crept around the bed, and she stood with her hands up again as she had before, just looking down on her husband, and that sound he was making, his eyes, you could see now, even through his lids, you could see the golden orbs of his eyes, but they were almost closed, and there was that rattle. His mouth was wide open, and such a smell coming out. And then it was as if somebody had walked into the room, though nobody did. Somebody that had a baseball bat, and they swung and cracked her on the back of the knees. It was as if that, because suddenly she went down on her knees beside the bed, and it was like it wasn't her will, and she took his huge hands and buried her face in the hands, and she said, "Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us, for thine is the kingdom, power, and glory." And when she said amen, Elijah was dead. And she just held his hands to her face. I knelt down behind her. I could do this. I could do this now, I knew. And I put my arms around her arms and his. And I said, "Helen, I have never seen a more beautiful chariot to carry a soul to heaven than your prayer." And the woman turned on her knees and threw her arms around me and burst into tears. Just wept, and so did I, and just wept and wept. At the funeral, let me tell you quickly before the funeral, at the wake, she did me a remarkable thing. At that point, pastors, black pastors in the area were really suspicious of me. The black people were beginning to get comfortable, and I was going to stay there a long time, but this is just 2 years, you know, and they were very suspicious what I was going to do. But she made them shake my hand. As they came in church, she knew every one of them, and they came because of her husband. This is an important figure, and she took their hands and made them go into my hand, and I'm swallowing now. Here's glory on glory, and they're scarcely even looking at me, but they've got to shake that hand, because they're, and then she got up on a box. All they could find, she wanted to get up and say something, and all they could find was a cardboard box. She had high-heeled shoes on. And so she kept popping, her high heels would pop through the cardboard. And you know, it sounded like gunshots right beside me. So there was a sweeter kind of glory going on here. She would say, and then she'd move around talking about her husband and the gratefulness of the things that had gone on. Pow! In return. And then I won't tell you, but you know, yeah, what I preached at the funeral service was this story, the one I just told you. I preached that story at the funeral service, exactly what I just told you. I need to tell you two things out of that. One is, there is one part that I made up, and perhaps you know what. This is talk now, this is talk to the alien. I took what he really did say to Etta Mae, and I said he also said it to his wife. But to this day, she believes he said it. And that's not wrong, because his soul was like that to his wife constantly. He was this glory. He kept being where there was darkness, even if the darkness was his own wife's anger and withdrawal. He kept shining that light, and he didn't feel upset. He didn't blame her, "Honey, I'm dying, can't you be more?" None of that. He constantly was there in her present darkness. He was the glory that broke through. And so even when I told her, you know, he didn't really, it didn't matter to her. After I preached that sermon, this woman, what it said in the bulletin, Lord's Prayer, she stood up and she turned around and she asked everyone to stand up and she led us in the Lord's Prayer. Glory unto glory. And I have so much yet to say. I will make one more point and tell you one more story. I can make this point quick, I think. I think so. We have time. We'll be on time. I don't mean here at the ending, I mean at Vespers.
Jesus gives us this remarkable example of hospitality in the 13th chapter of John. The source is there from the beginning, and anytime I read that, it moves me so deeply. Listen to this. Just listen to this. All along in John, Jesus has been saying, "My hour is not yet at hand." He said that at the wedding and so forth. But now before the festival of the Passover, Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart from this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them till the end. This is his source. And the end is going to embrace everything that happens on this night, because this is Thursday night. This is Maundy Thursday night. Tomorrow he's going to die. Having loved his own that were in the world, he loved them till the end. That's the source. And you know that the room is the place where they all gathered, that upper room. And you go to the other Gospels to find out the food that they ate there, which was the Passover, which became a covenantal meal for us all. We're all invited into this room. And so the food in the room, but the act of service. On the night in which he was betrayed, our Lord Jesus got up from the table and took off his clothes. Well, his outer garments. And wrapped a towel around his waist and filled a basin with water. And went to the feet, which are sticking out, you know, because they're all reclining. Their feet are sticking out around a U-shaped table. And began to wash their feet. He washed their feet. This is the service, which is very much a part of hospitality in almost any home. When people were invited in, he washed their feet. He got to Peter, you know, and Peter said, he couldn't stand the idea that Jesus was such a servant. Don't do that to me. And Jesus said, "Look, if I don't do it to you, you have no part in me." Peter says, "Whoa, a bath. Give me a bath." And Jesus said, "I don't do full body washes." Well, now there's a point to that. If Jesus washed all of Peter's body, besides all the theological stuff, that would make him a very near and dear servant or a slave. He would be high on the slave rolls. But if he only washes the feet, he's almost a nameless slave that only meets the guests and visitors. That's his only contact with them. That slave washes the feet and then takes the water off and disappears. Jesus is declaring himself to be at the bottom of the doulos role. That's why he doesn't do full body washes. And when he's done, then comes the talk. He sits down and he says, "Do you know what I've done to you? You call me Lord and Master, and so you should, for so I am. But if I, who is your rabbi, who is your master, the one you're following, should wash your feet, I have given you an example that you should do this unto one another." I'm shortening that text, but it finally gets to the second last beatitude. Jesus says, "If you know these things," and there's like a slash. "If you know these things," and that's not the beatitude. If you went to seminary and you learn these things, that's not it. If you went to Sunday school and you know all these things, if you were at Holden and you learned and you got it in your Bible and you could write it down, you can teach it to your children, that's not the beatitude. Good for you to know it. Blessed are you if you do these things. So simple. If you do these things, you are blessed. Now, dear people, what is the blessing? You've got to look at the whole of the 13th chapter of John. Immediately after that, there's this little mess about Judas. That's all. It's a mess about Judas for about 15 verses. There's a single event, and when Judas goes out into the night, then Jesus picks up where he left off, and he says in verse 31, "A new commandment I give you. Novum mandatum." This is Monday. This is the mandate Thursday. This is the commandment Thursday. "A new commandment I give you, that you love one another. By this," "even as I have loved you." Now, I know that phrase can embrace the whole of the sacrifice which is about to take place. But right now, immediately, what Jesus has just done is washed their feet and acted like the servant. "As I have just loved you, you must love one another." There's the picture. And you can go all the way to the cross if you want in the picture, because I think it's embraced by it. But right now, that's the picture. Washing the feet, being the doulos, the servant. "By this everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. And what shall be the blessing?" Now I'll tell you the story. This is true in every respect. But I want you to watch. This is how I learned the blessing. This is how I learned the blessing of the second last beatitude, what it was that we received. Some of you may have read this. I wrote it down. But it's a living story for me. It's about a man named Arthur Ford. Again, early at Grace. We had a fellow there who everyone
had trouble with. Okay, so here's the church. We had a single aisle up the center, no side aisles. This is very important. It went to the back. There are 9 pews here and 11 there. We went to the right, and then there were doors. We went down the steps into a little tiny narthex and out a door. Arthur Fort was retired. He had been a nurse's assistant in the hospital, Deaconess Hospital. He was retired. He would be the first one to church, and you'd think that was religious. I think it was because he wanted every religious person around to get uncomfortable, including me. Arthur stood like this. I don't think he ever bathed. He stood sort of like a toad standing up. Great big back sticking out like that. Chin, lips. He'd walk very, very slow. And he'd walk into that little narthex, standing with the outside door, the steps to the front. He'd stand right here and block everything and smoke his cigarette. This is before the days, you know, when that became what it is now in terms of proscribed activities. But, you know, I didn't like it. I mean, he was there, and we had a carpet, and I'm German. And he never flicked that ash. I would be up there pacing, getting my stern ready, and I'd start smelling cigarette smoke, and I'd look, and yep, there's Arthur. And what he would do is he'd lay that cigarette on his bottom lip and never touch it. He'd light it and never touch it again. I would watch, I'd talk to him, and, you know, I'm not looking at him in the eyes at all. I'm watching that ash start to bend down like an eyebrow. I'm waiting for him to sneeze or something, and it's going to hit the ground, and I'm going to try to swoop under and catch that. Doggone it, Arthur. I'm going to mess up the carpet. And that was only the beginning. When the Christians came to church, they had a way. Arthur would stand in that narthex, big as you please. They could go down to the basement if they wanted, but they couldn't go up to church. And you know how Christians get when they're upset, when they're practicing the virtue of patience? They can almost split a gut, but they do it silent. When Arthur got ready to move, he would climb those steps slowly, and all, it's like a train behind him. It's like actually a water. They want to burst by him and flood the church, sing hymns to God. You know. He's going down that aisle this slow, and I'm watching. In our church, which probably isn't in your churches, our people always sat in the same pew every Sunday. Generation to generation. I thought it was a wonderful thing when I saw it. I figured that they must have, you know, a butt print in the pew. You just find that one that fits you, and then it's comfortable. I got to tell you, there is a woman in our church still. She sits in the second last pew right by the wall. Right by the wall. She's as skinny as a rail. Her name really is Rosemary Smith. Her name is Rose Smith. She is the most generous and kind woman, but that's where she sits. I came to church once, and there was a white woman. Had come to church on her own earlier than anybody else. That white woman had sat in Rose Smith's place. Now, honestly, you think I'm making this up, but I'm not. She was the second one to church that day, because she's always early. She came to that second pew and she looked and she saw this white woman sitting by the wall where she always sits. I don't think she took a second. She walked on that pew and with her bony butt, she went between the wall and this woman. Watch this nameless white woman go. After church, I found out her name. Actually, she finally did join. Her name was Karen. And she said to me, "You have the most friendly people." Well, Arthur would take anybody else's pew. That's what Arthur would do. He would sit and he would just cause consternation. People would circle in the aisle like someone had tipped the universe. And then he would comment on my sermon. And then he would comment on my sermons while I'm preaching. And at first I thought he was saying good things. Until people, they would always get faces like constipation. And I realized what he was doing is he was playing double entendres on almost any word that I said. If I said suck a straw, guess what he was saying? I'm not making this up. It made me terribly nervous. I started watching all my language, every word, because almost every word in our language can become something foul. Arthur became housebound and we all sighed relief. He didn't come to church anymore. And we said, well, I didn't show. I'm glad. And then I got a phone call. It was like months later. Reverend, it was Arthur. Don't you visit. So, in those days I dressed in a suit. Guess how long that lasted. I went to visit Arthur, and now I'm going to tell you, this is not exaggeration. He lived on Maryland, which is a really bad street in our city. shotgun house. He didn't ever lock his door, and I pushed it in. He was sitting in a chair, and it wasn't housebound. He was chairbound. He couldn't get up. And so there was a urine smell. He had all over his floor newspapers, and he smoked his cigarettes and just spat them on the newspapers, but they were so moist that they would not catch fire. He had a television back here. He always had juice beside him, orange juice on a little table. When I came in, you could hear the roaches, like waves, skitter over those papers, just like waves. It was so bad, and they would plop off the walls. And Arthur looked at me with those twinkling eyes. I had brought communion and, you know, a little Bible. I was going to have a quick devotion and skedaddle. And he looked at me and he said, "Robert," and he motioned to an oily sofa. He said, "Have a seat. This is the last time I wear a suit." And he wanted me to come back. No, he did not want communion. No, he did not want prayers. This man wanted to argue, and he was exceedingly intelligent. It turns out he wrote poetry. And it was sometimes some of the most beautiful and the most sharp-tongued poetry that I had read. He, after several months, he would read it to me. But we would argue, people. He would argue me God. And I promise you, I kept walking out of his place just drenched in humiliation, because I felt I was not upholding God very well. And he was arguing God. "You," he said, "you never get me into a hospital." And he compared God to these doctors. Forgive me, but this is what he said. He said, "Doctor, come into a room, 30 seconds in a room, make a pronouncement from on high, charge $60, walk off." He said, "You never get me in a hospital." Now, I stood up for the doctors. I stood up for everyone. But Arthur then began to ask me to do things. He asked me to go to the bank for him, and I did. He asked me sometimes to actually clean out, get his juice, and I did. And then it got really hot in the summer, and I said, "Arthur, I'm going to get you an air conditioner." This is long about early August. He said, "No." Well, I said, "I'm going to get you a fan then." Because we did that. We had a lot of people to serve. And he said, "No." He said, "I can take care of the heat myself." And I went away. And when I came back the next Saturday, it was always on Saturday, I found out how Arthur was going to take care of the heat. I walked in, and there was my friend Arthur sitting in his chair, buck naked. Grinning. Buck naked and grinning. And this time when I came in, he said, "Reverend, I do believe I like the communion today." Now, can you imagine what is Arthur doing to me? First time he wants the host, you know, here, the bread and blood of our Lord Jesus Christ. I walk it up to him to put it in his mouth, and there's all of Arthur looking up at me. It gives a different cast to the whole idea of communion, I'll tell you. And the other thing he wanted me to do in those days was to dress him. The first thing was to put slippers on, split back slippers. But the other thing was that I was allowed to see him like that, but when others were going to come, even the juice man, he always wanted me to dress him, and that was horrible, people. It was so horrible, because to put pants on, he had to lean forward, and his legs are swelling hard as these beams. He leaned forward and put his weight on my back, and I'd have to lift his leg, and every time I lifted his leg, he would groan, and that groan would just go into my stomach so that I would groan as well. Pull the pant leg on, he'd groan. "Arthur," I'd say, "we don't have to do this." "Yes," he said, "we have to do this." And I would groan. I would groan the same as he, and we did that over and over. I wish I could give you the time, the amount I did it, and I never groaned less. I always groaned more. And yet he kept that twinkle in his eye. The man was playing with me in, I think, holy ways. September I came, he was out of his chair on the floor, fallen out at night, and he couldn't get back in because his legs were so swollen. And I said, "Arthur, you're going to the hospital." Now, everything I'm about to tell you is accurate. And what the people did at the hospital is not wrong. It's how I felt. I called, this is wrong. I called ambulance first, and they said their vehicles were all out. But it was Maryland Street, and we all knew better. So I called two members of my congregation, one very large, Clarence Fields. I dressed Arthur, and he groaned, and I groaned. I almost wept with the pain I was causing him. And Clarence and I carried him out to the station wagon. We drove to Deaconess. I put him in a wheelchair, and I went straight into the emergency. And I checked him in. And then I went to Arthur, and he was sitting listening in his chair, and he said, "Could I have a drink of water?" So I went to the nurse that I had checked in. I said, "He wants a drink of water. Can I get him one?" And she said, "No." And I said, "Why not?" And she said, "Because he has to see his doctor first before we allow him to ingest anything." And this is a rule that I perfectly understand. So I said, could you call his doctor? And she said, no. She said, that's not my job. It's the floor nurse's job. So I said, can I take him up? This is true. I said, can I take him up? I'm thinking he's thirsty in a wheelchair. She said, no, we will not be responsible. It has to be a nurse's assistant who takes him up, which is what he was. Half an hour. I knelt beside him. I said, Arthur, I'm so sorry. Half an hour. They waited, and he didn't get his water. And then when the nurse's assistant did get him up to the floor, I went to the nurse there and I said, he needs water, can I get him a drink? And she said, no, the whole business about doctor. I said, can you call the doctor? And she said, no, we're just changing shift, which is a difficult thing. And nurses have got to talk to each other. I know that now. But right then it just went through my skull because they wheeled him into the room and his smell had caused discussion up and down the hall. And those who didn't have water to give him a drink had water to wash him. They washed him. And I sat next to his bed and his eyes were closed for that Saturday afternoon until dusk. I sat by his bed and he only opened his eyes twice. The first time he opened his eyes and he looked around and he said this. He said, bloody but unbowed. I said, good Arthur, it's from a poem. It's not a great poem, but it's from a poem. I said, good Arthur, and I looked for a Christian that he could shiv him, you know. Make them nervous or make them patient or something like that. Good Arthur, I said, let's. And he looked at me and he said, bloody and bowed. It was about an hour later, he shot up. This heavy man shot up in bed and stared around with panic. Where am I? He said. And I said, Arthur, I'm so sorry. I took you to the hospital. And he still looked around, not at me, and he said, why am I? And he lay down. That night, I was in our house. The kids were in bed, Than was in bed. It was 11 or 12 and I was working on a sermon. And the telephone rang. And I answered the telephone and the voice identified herself as calling from Deaconess. And this is what she said to me. She said, Reverend Wongren, your father has just died. My father. Well, yes, he had no relatives. I checked him in. They heard him as Arthur Wongren. My father. And I cried. And this time I just cried. All night. And in the morning I talked to the church about Arthur. You know, dear people, why I cried. Because I loved him. Because everything that man did and all that I did in relationship to that man was to cause me to love him. That's why I was so upset with the hospital. I loved him. And I know that I loved him because he insisted that I dress him. He insisted that with his pain, nevertheless, I should do it. And I began to take that pain in as well. Man, my father. Yes, he was my father. And this is the blessing. This is the benediction. Blessed are you if you know these things. No, no, no. If you do these things one to another, if you serve one another naked and thirsty and hungry, the blessing is not that you will be loved. My brother tried to commit suicide twice. And then he met Kathy and they got married. And we had a long talk at some point. And he said, you know what made the difference? I said, yes, Kathy. And he said, yes, but not that she loved me, but that I could love her. This is the benediction, oh cold hearts. This is the benediction, oh fearful hearts. That when we serve one another enough to empty ourselves of whatever glory has been bequeathed us in this life, glory of education, glory of money, glory of authority, empty ourselves to find ourselves face to face with the others, I promise you, you'll be shocked at the fact that you will end up loving them. My son Joseph worked on what they called police accountability in Minneapolis. And he had to know the homeless and the prostitutes because he had to protect them from the potential of violence. And now he knows them all, and we walk downtown, and he loves them. All that I have said this week comes down to this single point. This is not the whole law. The whole law is that you should love. The whole blessing is that you may love. That you may love. So, God bless you. Go away and be blessed and shock yourself with this capacity to cry for the sake of other people. And they're not heavy tears anymore. They're not the myrrh. I mean, they are myrrh. We began with those tears, but they're the myrrh of sharing in the sufferings of others. But you shall be blessed.